wonderful meeting. Now, one thing I should say off the bat is that from my experience over the past couple of days or 3 days, philosophers are much more civilized than physicists are. And that's not something that I'm very much used to. So I would love to interrupt. I would love interruptions. Actually, I might be a bit upset if you don't interrupt me enough. But here we go. So, and there is Marcel. Hello. So I'm going to tell you about, I guess one of the possible applications of the things that we've been discussing over the past couple of days, that if you are willing to keep an open mind and question the way physics is done right now, then what are the possibilities? And what are the motivations for actually changing the way you think about physics? So, I mean, this is just a list of my collaborators. One of them is that from FQXI, who is one of the sponsors. So, I sponsors of this conference, so it's good to put it up there. And there are a bunch of papers that you can write, you can look for from my collaborators and I, and you can just find them on the archive. So from the title, you could guess I'm going to talk about the cosmological constant problem. And I grabbed this from the title of a recent paper by Carlo Rovelli and a collaborator, Why All These Prejudices Against the Constant. And I'm going to have a different point of view from the authors of that paper, and I'm going to tell you why we should have prejudices against a constant. And then I'm going to tell you about the alternative way to think about the problem without that constant, and that has to do with reviving ether, which is, I guess, a very old idea in physics, which has had a reincarnation in the past few years. And it's interesting that this reincarnation has come from very different directions with very different motivations. And these are some of the, and I'm going to go over some of these motivations, the quantum gravity, degravitating the vacuum, which has to do with the cosmological constant problem, the dark energy problem, the initial conditions problem. But let's start with the prejudices against the constant. So this paper came out, I guess, a couple of months ago. So it's April, May. So it's less than a month ago, more than a month ago, by Carlo Rovelli. He's a well-known researcher in quantum gravity, and a collaborator, Eugenio Bianchi. And so I'm just quoting a paragraph from their conclusion. So, but to claim that dark energy represents a profound mystery is, in our opinion, nonsense. Dark energy is just a catch name for the observed acceleration of the universe, which is a phenomenon well described by currently accepted theories and predicted by these theories, whose intensity is determined by a fundamental constant now being measured. The measure of the acceleration only determines the value of a constant that was not previously measured. We have only discovered that a constant that, so far, strangely appeared to be vanishing, in fact, is not vanishing. Our universe is full of mystery, but there is no mystery here. So how many people agree with this? How many people disagree with this? Okay, so I guess the rest of you haven't yet formed an opinion, but this is the key word. So the claim is that dark energy is no mystery. Now, I had different thoughts on what people mean by when there is no mystery somewhere. Certainly nobody predicted dark energy. Yes.
If you call it dark energy, it sounds like a mysterious ball of matter. Uh-huh. The point is, he says dark energy is just a catch name for the observed acceleration. So the proposal seems to be that there's just another fundamental constant.
Okay.
There isn't something called dark energy.
That's an excellent point. So whenever we observe a phenomenon, you can introduce a constant. or a parameter to explain that phenomenon. Now, that parameter might have been in your old theories or might not have been in your old theories. Now, is that enough? Does that mean simply because you can introduce a parameter to explain whatever phenomenon you have, does that mean that there is no mystery? Yes.
I think the mystery is related to the fact that if this were just a fitting constant, like, say, the Planck constant, then perhaps you're right. But the fact that it's related to vacuum energy makes it all very complicated. You know, it is somehow related to how we do not understand the fundamental vacuum of nature. And that is a mess from a direct perspective.
And I'm going to...
The early part of their paper, they argue against sort of the standard ways of thinking about vacuum energy. So, I mean, this is sort of an additional claim.
Well, this is the conclusion of that, and indeed they and I'm going to go over the arguments, and I'm not going to spend much time on this paper except for the categorical claims that they have. The point that I want to get across from this slide of this is that just if we predicted something and then we observe it, that's not a mystery, but we never predicted something and we observe it. Do you call it a mystery or not? And so I'm going to talk about the vacuum problem shortly. But so that's my question.
I mean, I was just responding. Yeah. I think there's the reason why people think it's a profound mystery is exactly as you're saying, the connection with vacuum energy. Mm-hmm. I think there's an earlier part of their paper where they say, we don't buy that connection. And so it does look mm-hmm. to them more like just a fitting question.
Yeah. So that's an excellent. So, and I'm going to talk about that point for a few slides now. But before that, I borrowed this beautiful slide from Marcelo. I really liked it. I just got it off after recording of his talk. And so there are several points in this plot that I wanted to elaborate on. One interesting thing is I really resisted not to mention during his talk was this picture that he has, the known and the unknown, or what did he call it? Perennial ignorance. And the boundary, is that right? We always often think that that's where perimeter sits. So we sit on the perimeter of the known universe, right at the boundary of the ignorance. And we are the gatekeepers of whatever that goes from one side to the other or vice versa. So any transaction goes through us. So that's the plan. On a more serious note, there is actually a more serious content in this plot, which has to do with a very important issue that researchers go on about and hydrogen physicists go on about for years. So you can think of this as a momentum space. And for a hydrogen, especially from the hydrogen physics point of view, this is the right analogy, that at low energies or at low momenta, you seem to understand everything. But then when you go to high energies or large momenta, then our experimental apparatus aren't strong enough to probe those regions, and our theories seem to break down, certainly at very high energies when you reach the Planck energies. And even possibly at much lower energies, if you believe people who believe in extra dimensions or large extra dimensions and things like that. So there is indeed a mathematical structure associated with this plot, which is our understanding of the behavior of Fourier modes. So Fourier modes with low momenta is in the known territory, and the Fourier modes with high momenta are in the unknown territory where we don't understand their behavior. And they are separated by a cutoff, as is technically known in quantum field theory, where is essentially the boundary of things that we know and we don't know. And this cutoff, and there is an important definition in particle physics which says a technically natural effective theory. Now, we don't know theory of everything. Every theory that we know is an effective theory. Some theory that describes the observables here because we don't have any access to observables out here. So any theory that we know is an effective theory, effective low energy theory. It's technically natural if it's insensitive to the position of the cutoff. So that's the key definition that I want to at least try to argue that this is something that we need to take seriously if we want to do physics in a sensible way. And indeed, the reason for this is that approaching this boundary is as approaching a region that we know nothing about. We may guess what's beyond there, but our guesses might be wrong, might be right. So if you have a theory down here in the so-called known territory that's somehow very sensitive to where you put that boundary or where you put the cutoff, that theory is not a reliable theory for that known territory because the position of that cutoff is very uncertain. Things get murky as you get close to this cutoff. So that theory is not a technically natural theory because the predictions of that theory depends on an unknown matching between the known and the unknown. And this is the problem with the cosmological constant, as I'm going to explain a little bit later. Examples of technically natural theories are as mundane as Newton's laws or as sophisticated as a standard model of particle physics. They are both effective theories that have a regime of applicability. We know that they don't describe our whole universe, but at the same time, we know that their predictions, where they are reliable, is insensitive to this matching between the known and the unknown. Yes?
The structure of the whole standard model, the Higgs structure is...
So that's, I guess, writing a slide at 3 a.m. in the morning, that makes you forget things. But yes, so a standard model with the exception of the Higgs, So, and that's why people basically invented supersymmetry to make Higgs a more natural particle or a natural element of the standard model, so things become less sensitive to the cutoff. Indeed. So thank you, Lee, for correcting me. So a standard model minus the Higgs boson is technically natural. Everything in a standard model, with the exception of the mass of the Higgs boson, and things that depend on that, are insensitive or only logarithmically dependent on the cutoff. A scalar sector of a standard model, which is the Higgs, and things that are fixed by the Higgs, they are not, and that's why people talk about supersymmetry. But that's thank you, Lee, for bringing that up. And the alternative to a technically natural theory is a theory that requires fine-tuning. So if you have a theory whose predictions depend sensitively on how you do this matching between the known and the unknown, that means that in order to fit observations, you have to fine-tune this cutoff, basically. And if you match observations well, but then you move this cutoff a little bit, then you become off. You go off by orders of magnitude. So your ability or your parameters of model are very sensitive to how you match between the known and the unknown. Yes.
This is a naive question. I can see why you'd like to say that about energy, but I mean, why? What are the rules of the game that you don't say that with respect to space or time? I mean, why aren't you worried about funny things happening and later?
You should be, absolutely. This is a simplistic plot. You should blame Marcello for that because he made it. But the thing is, that. The momentum of space is the right description of a linear theory, but of course, meaning all theories of nature are not really linear. They might be linear in some approximation, but they're not really. So in fact, all these unknowns here can affect things in the known territory and vice versa. And so there is no real boundary, sort of a speak. Simple problems, you might be able to write down a boundary like this, but in a nonlinear problem, there is no space where you can really separate the known from the unknown. At least in terms of the variables of the theory, there are always a mixture between high energy modes and low energy modes. You would think in a local theory, though, for example, things inside the black hole don't talk to things outside the black hole. For example, maybe you would think there is a cosmic censorship. So that's a stronger possibility. Although even in light of what I'm going to say later, I don't think that's the right expectation either. So I don't really think there is any space that you can draw the sharp boundary. There is always a mixture that can go deep inside the known territory. Okay? So let me tell you what is the problem with, and I guess I'm going to talk about quantum gravity as an example of the failure of this technical naturalness, because it is a nonlinear theory, and what happens in it is that the predictions in the so-called known territory, in fact, depend very much on how you do this matching. So there is the classical problem, which people have been talking about for decades, and that's renormalizability. And again, this is a technical term, but it's in simple, in layman's terms, it has to do. But one simple way of realizing this is that at some point in the Dirichlet times, or even at the centers of black holes, your theory of general relativity, the classical general relativity, breaks down, and then you have to, if you want to have a predictive theory, you have to transition to something else. People hope that a renormalizable theory would cure that. There is no proof of it, but we don't have a good, there is a long way from renormalizability to Big Bang singularity, but people think that if you have a renormalizable theory, you can solve the singularity problem. Yes?
I think of the Big Bang singularity as in some cases a curvature variant blowing up.
Yes.
And there are cases of singularities like that developing in hydrodynamics and other cases.
That's right, absolutely.
Are those unrenormalizable theories? I just don't quite.
Hydrodynamics. That's an excellent point. And I mean, that's actually the analogy that I want to get at eventually. In hydrodynamics, we know that your perfect fluid equations develop singularities. You're talking about shock waves, is that?
Yeah,
absolutely. But then if you add finite mean free path effects, viscosity, diffusion, things like that, then that regularizes the singularity or the shock wave. So that it smooths out the sharp transitions. And the hope is that something like that happens. It's much harder to do that in general relativity. People have come up with toy models. But the hope is that an ultimate theory of quantum gravity would do the job, because if it's an ultimate theory, it should be able to predict everything. I don't know. At least that's my expectation. But indeed, so there, in fluid mechanics, you do have singularities, and the way to cure them is to add these terms that include viscosity and things like that.
So may I just connect that? So how is that related to the breakdown of naturalness?
It does to the extent that you think observations into the universe depend on conditions at Big Bang. So if you think, for example, one possibility for initial conditions, if you assume you had a homogeneous universe at the Big Bang. But then, since theory is not really defined at the Big Bang, you cannot make that exact basis. So, yeah, I'm not going to dwell too much on this problem.
It isn't actually obvious that maybe you mean to apply this, that you actually want to cure the singularity problem so that dynamics that way. Mm-hmm. Actually, the singularities carry a lot of information. Viscosity is completely unnatural, and so you may not want to go that way at all. And I wouldn't say that.
So you think viscosity is unnatural? I mean, it occurs in nature. You can measure viscosity and so.
No, not the stuff that they stick in there just to smooth out the singularity. That may have no natural basis.
But there is a natural viscosity, you agree, in fluid.
Yeah, that's in your original equation.
Absolutely.
But that isn't sufficient to stop shock waves all the time.
But I didn't say to stop them.
It's one of the, nobody knows about the Navier-Stokes equation, but you know, their global behavior. So.
But you can't dissolve shock waves with, if you
act. That doesn't mean it's the right answer that you actually want to do. I didn't mean.
Well, no, I mean.
If you're making a methodological point, then I wouldn't say that.
No, but I mean, that's a physical point. So, Lee, you wanted to add to this? Or?
But it's a point in the same direction. I don't think of it as the normalizability would cure the Big Bang syndrome. Mm-hmm. I think of it as almost the opposite. What may cure the Big Bang singularity is a theory of the structure space time at the Planck scale.
Mm-hmm.
For example, as a Newtonian gravity or another triangulation or something like that, where there is a discrete structure at the Planck scale, and therefore the classical picture of the manifold becoming infinitely curved just breaks down, but unitary evolution can continue. But that's not what's usually thought of as a renormalizable theory. Renormalizable theory is one that's usually discussed in perturbation theory, and it means that at very short distances, the classical theory is mm-hmm. a very good approximation, and the quantum fluctuations are only corrected by small logarithmic corrections. And if there were a classical theory of gravity like that, one would certainly expect the Big Bang singularity to still be there because the quantum effects would be weak at short distances and wouldn't be strong enough to prevent the formation of singularity.
Well, I'm not sure. I think you're talking about asymptotic freedom as opposed to the
normalizable theory. And indeed, there are perturbative normalizable theories that extend general relativity. They don't have other good properties like analyticity or unitarity,
mm-hmm.
But there are such theories, and the Big Bang singularity is still there.
Well, I mean that they have other problems. That's why you have Big Bang singularity.
No, but the mm-hmm. contrast is that if general relativity is an approximation to a theory at short distances
mm-hmm.
where there is no continuum but a discrete structure, then in fact what's happening is the reverse of the story you're telling. What's happening is that gravity is a macroscopic artifact of the precise physics of the cutoff. And it's the opposite of the usual story of the normalizable field theory where the cutoff
but
is hidden.
I think, no, I completely agree with all you said. All I'm trying to say here is that the reason that general relativity is not renormalizable, and at least I think that's the reason you have singularities. Now, whether if you cure renormalizability, if you have renormalizable theory, that would cure Big Bang singularity. That depends on the theory. So I don't know how to define renormalizability for a discrete theory. So the whole concept of renormalizability breaks down because you're talking about a discrete set instead of a continuous. So you have a maximum cutoff. So yeah, I don't want to dwell on this too much. And obviously, you know more about this than I do. It's just that my hope is that you can't have a theory that's predictive, that's technically natural, you don't depend too much on the cutoff, and a theory that cures singularity in some sensible way. It might be through discreteness, it might be through some other means. But I think these are two issues that are related in some way. And there are proposals that are renormalizable and cure singularity in at this state claim. It's not generic. So let me go to my favorite favorite quantum gravity problems. And this is what Marcello and Chris, I think, were talking about. It's a so-called old cosmological constant problem that has been around for a long time, as far back as Pauli, apparently. Although I don't think he's published anything on this, but people have said that he's worried about this. And it's just that if you calculate the vacuum fluctuations of photons or any other field, you find densities that are much, much bigger than any density that we know on Earth. And now with the standard model of particle physics, if you just calculate vacuum fluctuations, you get some huge number of order of 10 to the 33 kilograms per cubic meter, which is obviously unrealistic. So this is the old cosmological constant problem. This is the thing that, I guess, Rovelli has been calling a non-problem.
So the rho is
fact that this is supposed to be the observed. The observed.
No, this is the prediction. Yeah, that's right. That's what I mean. That, and the problem is that the raw vacuum that you observe is much, much less than this.
Just on this, is it really the case? I mean, normally one says Saladovich was the person who got the vacuum in the 1960s. So Pauli was really thinking
he mentions it in correspondence. I forget where, but this is way back in the
30s,
I think. Yeah, there's a paper by Enns which quotes the correspondence, but I don't remember exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he hasn't published on it, so that's a bit curious, because, I mean, maybe this is really an embarrassment for, I think, for theoretical physics of 20th century. So maybe it's not surprising that Pauli hasn't written on it. So this is a problem. So you make a prediction, and you don't see it. Now, of course, the claim is that you make a prediction for the things that you see, and there are fields in the universe that you possibly don't see, so those could somehow exactly cancel this, and you see you get the observed raw vacuum density, which is much, much smaller than 10 to the 33 kilograms per cubic meter. So that's the example of a fine-tuning, or a breakdown of technical naturalness, that an addition of the known and the unknown that I haven't written here somehow determine the observables in our universe. And the answer depends sensitively on how you separate the known from the unknown. Basically, this answer goes as a fourth power of the cutoff. So if you arrange a very fine-tuned cancellation between known and unknown, and then you move the cutoff a little bit, then you generally expect this to, again, blow up to some huge, huge number. Yes?
Just a footnote in causal reasoning literature. The causal faithfulness condition does something similar, that you wouldn't see very small correlations if there are strong causal pathways, because that would require near cancellation. So
yeah.
You have a similar kind of principle.
Okay, so I see. Thank you. Yeah. So there is the new cosmological constant problem, and I guess this is also something that Rovelli and company call a non-problem. This is the fact that long after Pauli's observation, we had an observation of our own, the cosmologists, and this raw vacuum was measured to be some 60 orders of magnitude less, to be non-vanishing, and some 60 orders of magnitude less than the predicted value, or quote-unquote predicted value. Now, the problem is that you might have imagined, now the reason these two are different problems is that you might have imagined you have a mechanism that makes this raw vacuum exactly zero, so there is some symmetry of nature that is yet unknown to us, but might have existed that made this exactly zero. But obviously that's not the case, because now we measure raw vacuum to be not exactly zero. And that's why actually many prominent scientists still don't believe this observation, because basically it doesn't make any sense to them that you either have a symmetry that makes it zero, or you don't have a symmetry that then it would be as big as it can be. That's what many people think. But of course, and more people are now making their peace with the observation, which has more bigger, better and better accuracy over the past 10 years. So this is the new status of the problem. And there is this also mystery, which, again, Rovelli et al. Don't believe is a mystery, is that the vacuum density as observed and the matter density today, they are comparable. And the mystery about this is that the matter density over the age of the universe changes by tens of orders of magnitude. The vacuum density is a constant. How come just when we are observing them, they are comparable to each other? So I think, to say the least, this is the failure of predictivity for theoretical physics. And there is one solution that's very popular in the literature. You have the so-called landscape multiverse solution, which says that there are all possible choices of cosmological constants. When I say CC, I mean cosmological constants, that are realized in the multiverse, all these multiple possibilities of our universe in different causally disconnected regions. And we happen to live in the universe that are universes that are habitable. Or we can live, I guess, we happen to live in one of the universes that is habitable. Sorry for the wording. And here, I guess I'm going to quote Wikipedia, so I'm not going to make many statements on my own. So critics claim that many of these theories lack empirical testability and without hard physical evidence are unfalsifiable outside the methodology of scientific investigation to confirm or disprove. So we have a lot of distinguished philosophers and physicists in the room. So I guess am I correct to assume that some of these critics are here? Yes, I guess based on the talks we've heard. Now,
is that a quote of Lee?
No. Yeah.
let's just be
So, now, is there anybody here actually who, now, it might be hard for the people in the minority to raise their voice, but somebody might disagree with this statement. Yes. Yeah. you guys disagree with this.
Well, I don't so much disagree with that, but the notion of falsifiability mm-hmm. as being a way to do what should be Bayesian, scientific method should be Bayesian mm-hmm. statistics applied to our data,
yes.
whatever that means. And falsifiability, Popper's views on things are disputable, to put it mildly.
Okay, good,
Whether, falsifiability, well, that's nice, but you can't falsify paleontology, to give some mm-hmm. of those trivial examples.
Yeah.
So I still think that this carried a lot of strength mm-hmm. through it, the statement, but whether unfalsifiable should be underlined, let's put it that way.
So, Julia,
why can't you falsify paleontology?
You can't go back and do an experiment on it.
Oh, for that reason?
But you could find a fossil in the wrong rock stratum.
That would modify your notion of paleontology. Falsifiability, to do actual science, if you agree with Zucconetti or Cox or any of those itemizations, science should be an exercise in Bayesian statistics.
Okay.
There's nothing in Bayesian statistics that says when I have a great amount of data and I'm making an inference that somehow there's got to be this magic ability to do an experiment to test something. If you can, that might be...
Okay, so I'm gonna use my position here to interrupt this. I'm sorry, guys, but this is... Chris is telling me I don't have much time, so this is a cut. But Julian, you wanted to make a
very
short point.
Never believe anything you find on Wikipedia. I got a letter a year ago saying, "Have you noticed, according to Wikipedia, you died 3 years?" And it was true. That's what Wikipedia said. I'm the proof.
But so I guess then this is a chance for people who disagree with this to go on Wikipedia and change this.
Wikipedia is falsified, well, that's great.
Perfectly true statement.
We don't know
but is that
perfectly true statement, we could explain that.
Yeah. No, this is the perfectly true statement, absolutely.
Other people disagree with those critics?
Exactly, that's right. So, actually, now, to be frank, this is most of the things that Wikipedia was in favor of multiverse. This is like one of the few sentences was against it, and so I just picked that one. So, this is, at least from my point of view, and I agree there are all these philosophical questions with falsifiability, what that means. But it seems to me that there is a question about how you want to do physics in the 21st century. And there are two sets of principles that we can, in my opinion, are mutually exclusive. It's either Karl Popper's falsifiability and predictivity that some people seem to think is the bedrock of scientific endeavor. And there are more traditional views of specifically 20th century. And there are due to basically the two most famous endeavors of 20th century in physics. There is ideas of Lorentz symmetry, four-dimensional diffeomorphism invariance, locality, and they are all related very closely to each other. And, I mean, so the Einstein believed that there couldn't be an action at a distance. That's really locality, and that eventually leads to all this all the ideas in special and general relativity. Yes.
Since Popper's picture is up there,
yes.
I'd like to at least say that in his book, as opposed to the folklore, what he's proposing is Occam's razor, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's an explicit theory of what simplicity is in there. And falsifiability is explicitly portrayed as an attitude. It's a scientific attitude. It's not a property of the theory. So the attitude is, I have to say up front under what conditions I drop my credence in the theory. And then he recommends that the way that conventional rule be set up is according to simplicity. So really he was talking about something like I was yesterday.
I see. So you think it's not falsifiability, it's simplicity?
He says if you're really a scientist, then you have to say up front what would count as dropping the theory. So the bogeyman in logic of scientific discovery is a conventionalist strategy where I rotate auxiliary hypotheses to save the core theory at all costs.
Mm-hmm.
And his view is that if you have that strategy, then you'll never get to the right answer if the theory happens to be false. So you have to say up front, okay, here's my schedule for when I'll drop this thing.
Okay, good.
When to drop?
So that's exactly it. And I guess I put that as a challenge to people who defend multiverses, that then what observation does it take for them to drop that point of view? So that's, if they answer that question, then I'll be happy.
Closed universe.
Yes, what is that?
Closed universe.
No. I'm sure you can come up with models that closed.
I would drop it.
You would drop it. But I think many others wouldn't. I mean, but I can come up with a theory of a multiverse which gives you closed universe. But you think that's the line, that if you see closed...
That's an example of a line.
Yeah. Good. Well...
Good evidence against inflation.
Good evidence against inflation,
so
like what?
Some really baroque inflation model, you know, strong Mount-Gaussianities or something, or... then I would...
So you think a strong non-Gaussianity would rule out multiverse?
No, it would rule out, but you're asking when do you give it up?
So you're going to give it up. Okay, perfect. Now, if you could get all the people who believe in multiverse to agree on this, well, maybe that's too much to ask. But anyway, so this is a personal question at this point, I think. That this is the way we've done physics for the past 100 years. And this is the way we've done in practice physics for the past few centuries. And I think you should... you should go one of these two ways. You should either stick with the multiverse. In my view, that's betraying falsifiability, if not dropping it. Or stick with the conventional physics, which gave us the quantum gravity and cosmological constant problems. And it's not surprising that I'm going to go with the second one. With the next, I guess I have 5 minutes, right? Yeah. So, I'm just at the second.
I'll fly.
So I just finished the introduction.
What is interesting about this is, I think, as far as the organizers have gone, I'm the only one who gave an explicit warning to let the speaker move on. And you've got the worst.
No, I mean,
so far.
Well, he prompted questions. He's interrogating the audience.
So I'm not going to go through these in detail, but this is basically the idea, that the alternative, basically. Right? If you decide not to go with the multiverse route, then you have to break either Lorentz symmetry or unitarity or both of them. And I think, what I was going to tell you about, and I might give you just a couple of lines about them, is that that's equivalent to reviving the gravitational gravity's ether, which was a theories of gravity before Einstein. And that has already been discussed in the context of quantum gravity, the gravitating vacuum, cosmological constant problem, dark energy, and initial conditions. So I guess the thing that I can talk about now is... So I had all this stuff about quantum gravity theories, and let me just... There are different possibilities, but ether theories are basically a possibility for quantum gravity which breaks the four diffeomorphism invariants into a three diffeomorphism invariant plus possibly other symmetries, but basically this is the idea is that you give up on Lorentz invariance, and you would argue that Lorentz invariance is just an emergent low energy theory of nature, and at high energies you have other symmetries, maybe a lower degree of symmetry of the universe, or a different a deformation of Lorentz invariance. And this is the cosmologist's favorite because it, as it turns out, our universe has exactly done this for us, has broken the four diffeomorphism invariance, has managed to pick a frame, which is the cosmic microwave background frame. It is still three diffeomorphism invariant. It's still homogeneous and isotropic. However, it's not homogeneous in time. So it does change with time. And that's... So that in my opinion, then, that's exact... It's that, this sounds very natural from the cosmological point of view, just based on observations, because universe have managed to do this. So maybe this is a fundamental property of nature. Because that means that there is a preferred frame, and you can call that preferred frame an ether. So a preferred frame, you can think of it as just a preferred direction in a space or time, but you can always make the covariant theory covariant, make this picture covariant in a covariant framework, and then that frame becomes dynamical, like a fluid. So you don't have to think of this preferred frame as something static that's sitting in a space. It could have its own dynamic the same way that fluid has its own dynamic.
You wouldn't call that breaking Lorentz invariance, would you? I mean, you still have local Lorentz invariance and being Robertson Walker. The solution is not...
The solution has broken it, yes. But not the...
Not what the laws, but this.
That's right. But it's striking that the solution hasn't broken all the Lorentz invariants, but only one part of it. So you still have three diffeomorphism invariants. So you could say that somehow there is some randomness initial conditions that has done, managed to do it. Or you could say that this is the fundamental feature of our universe, that at the fundamental level there is no four diffeomorphism invariants. And the reason this is exciting, actually, this possibility, is that this could be a way to make gravity renormalizable. Now, this has been known before, but Hojava in particular stressed that if you have a theory where frequency goes as, a theory of gravity where frequency goes as wavelength to the power of -3, omega goes as k cubed, then it's at least power counting renormalizable, which is... At least it hasn't been proven that the theory is renormalizable, but at least at the dimensional level, it's renormalizable. And obviously, this kind of dispersion relation is not Lorentz invariant. You might have a different symmetry, but at least the Lorentz symmetry, as it's written often, is not preserved here. So, if you think at the fundamental level gravity is renormalizable, which means that your theory is insensitive to cutoff. Then this the breaking Lorentz invariant provides a way. So let's see. So again, I don't want to spend too much time on technicalities. So if you close your eyes for a minute, okay. So this Hojava-Lipschitz gravity is a very concrete proposal. But at low energies, it looks like something looks like this. So it's a standard general relativity plus a term that is a square of extrinsic curvature or mean extrinsic curvature. And it turns out that this term, and you don't have to pay attention to the details here, this term is like adding an incompressible fluid to your theory of general relativity. And I guess we've done something that's similar to this. It's called Kaskuton, but I'm not going to go into details. And the interesting thing is that the preferred frame, as I said, there is a preferred frame. And that preferred frame or preferred gauge in this theory are the constant mean curvature surfaces. And I think, Julian, are you going to talk about this?
If
If you get there, yeah. I promise to finish on time for you.
No, I'm worrying about myself.
Okay, maybe I'll finish a bit earlier.
This scrappy audience.
Yeah. No, don't worry. They will be nicer to you. So these constant mean curvature surfaces are really surfaces, I guess I have missed something. So there are surfaces where K is just a constant, is a function of time. And this K is essentially expansion rate. And it's interesting that these two emerge from very, very different points of view. They emerge, one from trying to denormalize gravity, and the other emerges from, what Julian is doing, just emerged from requirement of conformal invariance, or some version of conformal invariance. And they both get you at the same thing, that there is a preferred frame, and that preferred frame, in fact, are CMC, constant mean curvature surfaces. There are actually more ways. So I guess this is what I just told you, that this emergent renormalizable gravity becomes just general relativity plus an incompressible ether. And there's interesting coincidence, because Riemann, in his infinite wisdom, back in 1853, and again, I'm again quoting Wikipedia here, so had an incompressible gravitational ether exactly in those terms.
I think that's accurate.
Is that right? Okay, good.
And he is dead.
But his spirit lives on.
His spirit lives on with us. So it's amazing that after 150 years or so, we end up with a theory of gravity, at least that are these different rods that give us the same something similar, an incompressible fluid as a part of a theory of gravity. So now I'm really over my time. Not really.
It's a question of how much discussion you want to take in versus how much discussion at the end. We should at least leave 20 minutes at something like that.
Okay. So let's see. Do I have? Let me just show you the outline again. So I'm not going to go over this in much more details unless you ask me to. So I told you about the motivation from quantum gravity, and basically that there is a strong suggestion that different considerations tell you that there is the preferred frame, which, in other words, yes.
Yeah. So since you raised the issue of falsifiability,
yes,
and having to make a stand, and so forth, how much experimental confirmation of Lorentz invariance at the Planck scale, which there already is considerable to first order in L Planck, would force you to give up the idea that there's a preferred frame of reference?
You believe in deform special relativity, right? I mean, you think that's still a theory hasn't been tested?
I'm asking you.
You're asking me, yeah. I thought that was a nice thing.
Because your theory proposes that there is just a global time and Lorentz invariance is broken. And we can be sympathetic or not, but there are by now decent experimental checks, especially with photons, that strongly constrain breaking of Lorentz invariance at the Planck scale. So why haven't you already given up these ideas, or at least how much better could the
combination
of Lorentz invariance get before you will give them up?
Well, I mean, if I have a prediction, somebody makes a prediction from these theories that is ruled out, then that would be the way to rule it out. But,
So how large do you think? Well, maybe this is too technical discussion for now, but. Now, how large do you think the dimension 5 term in photons delta out across d is?
I don't know. I mean, I have absolutely no idea. One thing I do know is that you need a natural mechanism to suppress that. And until we have that natural mechanism, we cannot really answer that question. So if nobody can find that natural mechanism, then one has to give up on this at some point because of the falsifiability question, because you cannot make a prediction for that particular observation. If not, somebody should make a prediction for this. That's basically my point. So, I mean, one way is your way to deform Lorentz symmetry instead of breaking it.
Yeah. Hmm? Yes.
That's right.
That's a hypothesis.
Yeah, and I think I have to make it more explicit. I mean, that's, I think, a very real possibility, for example, and as you know, in Hojava's gravity, that Lorentz symmetry is not really broken, but it's just slightly deformed to a different symmetry.
And but now we're speculating about theoretical developments that have not yet worked.
Yeah. Okay, so now the reason that I am excited about this is that this is not just a theoretical speculation to solve theoretical problems. You can actually make predictions, not in interaction with photons that Lee is interested in, but in regards to the cosmological constant and dark energy. And I'm not going to take you through the horror of the equations. I just want to say that you can come up with a theory with which I call gravitational ether, I guess, which is without much creativity, and there is no free parameter in it other than those in the general relativity. And let me just, and this is an example of a prediction of those predictions of those theories, that it predicts that some parameter that some of you may not care about is different. So the parameter is in fact G Newton, the ratio of gravitational constant today to the gravitational constant during radiation era. And these are the current constraints on it from microwave background data and a microwave background from Lyman Alpha Forest. And the best constraint is actually prefer ether to general relativity at about 2 sigma.
Lyman Alpha Forest gives you strong evidence for changing gravitational constant?
Yes. But it's a very special kind of changing gravitational constant that...
Talk about that.
Absolutely.
I should tell you why you should worry about the
I do worry about it every day, but so there is no fine tuning here. There is no fine tuning. There is no parameter, but this just comes out. So this might go away. So I might have been lucky for the past couple of years, but as it is right now, there is a concrete prediction that hasn't been ruled out, and in fact, it's more consistent with data than general relativity is. Of course, in cosmology, you can always add other parameters to make things work. But if you want to be minimalistic, this theory is preferred. So there are concrete predictions. So I guess I didn't really tell you exactly how it works. But the old cosmological constant problem can be addressed in the context of ether. So let me just give you a flavor of how it works with the dark energy problem. Basically, the idea is that, and it's, you can make this very concrete, the idea is that ether is uniform at early times, and then at some point black holes work, black holes form, and they source, or you could either say they heat up the gravitational ether, or they source it at their horizons, and eventually, so that's, these are stellar black holes that we know exist in the universe. And eventually, they lead to acceleration of the universe at ratios of 0.5. And this is just the story, but the story can be actually made much more concrete if you just used a standard thermodynamics. So,
what did you mean by sourced? That's a word I don't know.
Well, so ether is a fluid which has.
It's flowing out of black hole.
The current picture, its pressure is set. The boundary conditions for its pressure is set at the horizons of the black holes. So by the source, I mean that its pressure is set at the horizons of the black hole. And the story, the way it works, and again, I guess I'm telling you where black hole thermodynamics comes from. And again, this is a lot of technicality you can just ignore. But the idea is that if you just take a standard relationship for black hole thermodynamics and assume that there are corrections to it that are suppressed by powers of M Planck, say one power of M Planck, and then plug that in the standard thermodynamics, which is d energy is TdS minus PdV, so T is the temperature of the black hole, S is the entropy of the black hole, P is pressure, V is the volume. If you just plug in this standard relationship with Planck suppressed corrections, you get a value for the pressure, which is comparable to the dark energy pressure for a stellar black hole. So, again, I don't really expect you to follow the details, but the idea is that if you assume that there is a fluid, and you assume that it couples to black holes in some way, and then you assume that there are corrections that are given by M. Planck, that are suppressed by M. Planck to black hole thermodynamic relations, then the pressure of dark energy naturally comes out of it without any fine tuning. So in fact, this correction from a current observation of dark energy, the first correction to black hole entropy is constrained to be minus 3.1 plus or minus 0.4 times 10 to the minus 3. So some factor of order 1 for black hole masses of 10 solar mass, which we expect, we think, are the majority of black holes in the universe. So this is how the dark energy problem is addressed. So there is no fine tuning. You only say that there are Planck suppressed corrections to black hole properties, and then you assume thermodynamics, and then the pressure drops out.
But we have the ratio of the mass of black holes to 10 solar masses there.
Yes.
Change that ratio, the numbers change.
Yeah, so but this ratio, we know what this ratio is actually. We have observations of black holes. So you have observational constraints on this rate, on this value. And because you can measure masses of black holes, at least some of them, not all of them, but as since universe is more or less homogeneous and uniform, you know if you measure some of the black holes, most of them are going to be similar to them. And yes, indeed, the masses are close to 10 solar mass. So you're right. If this was a free parameter, then there would be a huge uncertainty. But this is a parameter that you can measure. And that turns out. So, and this is actually, again, you don't have to follow the details. This is actually different measurements, well, quote-unquote measurements on this value of solar mass, a stellar black hole mass, or the black hole mass, which is somewhere between 10 and 30. So there is some uncertainty in it, but it's not very big. And as I said, there is no fine-tuning. So let me address one last problem, which has been mostly discussed here. I think the initial condition, so that must be a topic that's close to many of your hearts. And I guess Chris also talked about it, and Lee talked about it, and Roberto talked about it. So I think that the Hojava-Lipschitz gravity, or the ether theories, actually provide the context or solution to the initial condition problem. And basically, the solution that they provide is that there is an initial surface at which the speed of sound blows up. So essentially, time drops out of your equations at some initial point. And at that point, you can actually set your initial conditions at that point, and very naturally, you could either assume a thermal state or a Bunch-Davis vacuum at this initial surface. And there is some ambiguity about the way to do it, but not much. And a scale invariant power spectrum just comes out of this formalism. And I guess there are different ways of doing it. Mukayama and Magueja have provided, I think Lee and Magueja and Carlo Cantaldi have a different, somewhat similar proposal to this. But the idea is that the initial condition problem can become irrelevant if a speed of propagation diverges at some point. At some point, basically, time becomes irrelevant, which is, I guess, not very a favorite. That's not the favorite scenario for some of you.
So that's all the horizon problem. You have inflation in this.
No,
problem.
There's no inflation.
This does away with inflation.
Yeah.
It gives you
some water. It doesn't.
But you assume homogeneity, or?
Well, It's. I mean, all the approaches to these are perturbative, so they assume homogeneity. Whether you can actually get homogeneity out of this is a somewhat non-perturbative question. So I don't really have an answer to that. I think it's possible, but I'm not sure.
Yes. Is it scale invariant or nearly scale invariant?
I think it's exactly scale invariant. Well, I think there are some free parameters in these theories. I'm not very familiar with them. But the natural thing is a scale invariant. Now, how much you can deviate from that, I'm not sure. So I guess what Anthony is referring to is that there is, from this data, there is evidence, some 3-sigma evidence of deviation from a scale invariant. So you have your 4% away from a scaling variance. So, whether you want to take that seriously, like many cosmologists do, I'm not sure that that comes out of these theories naturally.
Planck will measure that very well.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So that would be, so it's good for these guys to fine tune, to basically specify their theories as accurate as they can, because Planck will rule them out soon. Or confirm them, who knows. So, there you go. So this is my conclusion, and sorry it took a while to get through it. So this is a very opinionated conclusion, and I guess that's why we have some time for discussion. So in my opinion, in facing the most transcendental puzzles in cosmology, which, again, in my opinion, are cosmological constant problem, dark energy, and singularity problems, I think we have two ways. And this is, and I guess you're going to object to this, I'm sure. So you can either give up falsifiability and predictivity in a cosmological setting, or you can give up locality, unitarity. I didn't say much about unitarity, but it turns out that it's very, very much tied to locality. In the theories that I wrote down, some of them you couldn't write an action for them. Now, I'm not sure if that's a fundamental feature of these theories, but at least the simplest thing that you could write down, they didn't have an action. So I'm guessing you cannot write the unitary theory for them. But the main thing is locality. And Philip tells me that there is a connection between these two. Do you agree? Yes, I guess in his derivation of unitarity, there must be some notion of locality.
Well, it's not. I'm not sure how tight that connection
is. But there might be some. So this is an interesting, intriguing possibility. So I don't know. I'm not sure either. But the locality is the main thing that I had to break by introducing ether, basically. And this is an incompressible ether, so the speed of propagation for it is infinite. And so I think the latter amounts to a revival of gravitational ether with concrete, and so far successful. And obviously this can be ruled out, as Anthony pointed out, and many of you pointed out. But this is the main point is that there are concrete predictions that can be tested. They have been successful so far. Very good predictions have been made. But they may be ruled out. So this is an alternative. Thank you.
We have 15 minutes for discussion.
Yes?
This might be a naive question, but when I've looked at the sort of formulations of the cosmological constant problem, it's sort of striking that you... it's not as if the problem follows just straightforwardly from general relativity and quantum field theory. Mm-hmm. There are assumptions that you have to make about how the zero-point fluctuations of the quantum field enter into the renormalized stress energy tensor and couples the gravitational field and so on. And then you get this calculation, which you can show as, you know, or 100 order of magnitude, off. But there's assumptions that you make about how general relativity fits into this picture in order to make that calculation. I think. And the way you were discussing it, it's sort of thinking of general relativity in this effective field theory framework in a particular way. I was just wondering if there are people who've worried about whether that's the right way of thinking about GR. Whether, I mean, I think some of this came up in Lee's comments about how to think about GR in these terms. And is there any way of evading the
cosmological? So you think that
there's assumptions that go into the calculations that lead to this.
So let me clarify this. So you think that there might be an alternative to effective field theory
approach? I'm not sure how to talk about the effective field theory approach when we're looking at GR as opposed to field theories formulated in a special relativistic.
And Lee's an answer to that.
Okay.
No, well, two points which address it. So one of them is, you're quite right, I mean, the statement of the problem, the first of the old problem, relies on assuming that it's a good approximation to couple the classical Einstein equations to the expectation value of the energy from another tensor. That by itself is not a consistent theory. And say, Carlo Rovelli's point would be that there is not actually a derivation of that from first principles from a quantum theory of gravity, and it might be that a correct first principles calculation from a quantum theory of gravity resolves the problem. Another point related to that is that there is a middle, there's a kind of middle ground, which addresses the old cosmological constant problem, but not the new cosmological constant problem or the coincidence problem, which is a formulation of general relativity that goes back to Einstein called unimodular gravity, which probably NIOSH has a transparency about.
So
which I think it's fair to say, well, NIOSH's proposal, which is very ingenious, does two things. One of them, it shares with unimodular gravity in that it decouples the trace of the energy momentum tensor, or it decouples the vacuum energy or any contribution to energy proportional to the metric from the Einstein field equations. But NIOSH's proposal then makes a dangerous move in addition to that, which is either wonderfully bold or foolishly bold, but vulnerable to check, which is that it puts it in the context of a theory which has occurred for a time, which breaks Lorentz invariance, which then makes it vulnerable to these other experimental checks. So it could be a great move and it could be a foolish move. But there is the middle ground, the sort of wimpy version of NIOSH's, which is Einstein's unimodular gravity. Is that fair?
Absolutely. I wouldn't put the brave, the foolish, I think, is the right chance, so I wouldn't just drop the brave part. But this is indeed the unimodular gravity. And, I mean, I agree with all you said, but there is a way of stating cosmological constant problem in terms of effective field theories. And that's just by introducing a cutoff, right?
You don't need the brave.
Yeah. So the cutoff, but see, the problem is what it's a technical naturalness problem, is what I was telling you here, which is you can introduce a cutoff and you can do everything consistently in a quantum mechanical framework. It's just that the problem is that everything changes if you move a cutoff a little bit. And yeah, so I mean, you could do either semi-classical gravity, which basically essentially what I did, I just took and modified some classical gravity where gravity is classical, but everything else is quantum mechanical, and you took expectation values of everything to plug into Einstein equation. That's what I modified, basically. I modified some classical gravity by introducing ether, which is completely classical, actually. The alternative is to do it in effective field theory, and I don't think there is any way to avoid the cosmological constant problem okay, so there is unimodular gravity that does have an action, but there is an initial condition problem there that the cosmological constant becomes an integration constant. So there is still a fine tuning of a different sort. It's not in the momentum cutoff, but it's in how you set the boundary conditions for the universe. So you should somehow at Planck time, you should set the value of this integration constant to be very small, as big as we see today, basically. So that's so the unimodular gravity, in my opinion, changes the nature of the problem, but still there is a problem of some sort. It just changes its nature. It's an initial condition problem now instead of a fundamental problem in the cutoff. Yeah. Thanks.
It's kind of a naive historical question. It's actually for doing Mark product hydrodynamics, and I'm just wondering. I'm not sure I have my chronology. When hydrodynamics was developed, there were people who thought that matter was continuous still. I'm wondering if that's the case, what was their attitude towards singularities?
Well, you saw the Riemann quote that. I mean, that was a predecessor of all the vortex theories, and the vortex is a singularity in something like an Euler fluid, this compressible fluid, perfect fluid. And that was the prevailing view of matter, that actually mass was okay.
Right, so they didn't have the equivalent of what quantum gravity would do, which would be this sort of
molecular picture of the underlying fluid that would resolve the singularity. Because that's one way to resolve the singularity worry. Okay, this is defective theory, it's not continuous at the ground level. That wasn't in the picture.
Like Newton was an atomist, waiting for all.
Well, there was atomism, but I'm just thinking there were. This isn't disagreeing.
I'm not just totally catching your question.
Well, I'm trying to think. I'm saying that this kind of problem is.
So let me try to.
Not new. And,
but let me try to answer that. I don't think viscosity was long known. I mean, because you cannot make sense of fluid mechanics without viscosity.
Well, Mark's point was that viscosity is already in the equation. Wasn't it?
We don't know about the Navier-Stokes equation. Which is your standard, okay. I mean, the basic model of fluid mechanics is the Eulerian fluid, which is incompressible and doesn't have viscosity. Okay. Yeah. Then Navier and then Stokes, go down the Navier-Stokes equation, which just adds a simple, what we call Newtonian viscosity. Mm-hmm. And these are completely unmanageable equations, but they're still very mysterious in their behavior. Okay.
But
the general fact that just because you have a viscosity term, an equation does not prevent blow-ups. Now, a viscosity term can prevent blow-ups. Okay. So, in the gas equations, you know, they will put an artificial, they can have a real viscosity, but then they have an artificial viscosity to try to tame those singularities. That's an important mathematical trick to use. But it was actually Riemann's attitude, and it would still be prevailing in lots of treatment of continuous matter. Now, the whole framework's different, because everybody knows that there's molecules, so in a shock front, mm-hmm. there's all this molecular activity. It's just that you can't smooth it over and use a continuum description there. So detailed understanding of shock waves moves to molecular theories. Right. But if you don't want to go to that level of modeling, mm-hmm. you usually want to, it's often advantageous to keep it as a singularity. And lots of modern work in continuous matter encourage, you know, through weak solutions and so forth, the acceptance of quite singular solutions. And singular fronts are important modeling elements, so you don't want to smooth them out. And that was actually, this is all a digression, but it's what I say. Riemann's own attitude in that was the thing about the singularities, the sinks, right? The sources. That we understand so many things in mathematics and physics that singularities, though the equations are breaking down, they're your friends in terms of understanding the phenomena. Because it's in the representation with the singularities you can have some understanding. You smear out those singularities and you just get numbers that you don't understand very well. So, anyway,
yeah,
that was Riemann's attitude. So.
No, I don't disagree with anything that you say, but I mean, just saying, only thing I want to add to that is that in order to make sense of a fluid mechanics equation, I mean, you need to add something, either a molecular description or a viscosity prescription, and you can formally show that in some situations the two are equivalent in low energy situations, but nevertheless, you have to add it all the time. And the thing that's missing in quantum mechanics as it is that its unitary description doesn't allow any dissipation. And in fluid mechanics, we know that there would be dissipation. If you can push this analogy a little bit more, fluid mechanics, we know that even very smooth flows have some dissipation in them. So there is some give and take between this known boundary and unknown boundary, where you can model that has a viscosity, but the main point is that in order to be consistent, you should always include it, and quantum mechanics never includes it. So unitarity, I think, it might be if you can push this fluid mechanics analogy, quantum mechanics might be the right description when you are very far from this boundary, but then there is always some corrections that. Maybe they're due to the presence of this boundary, and they break unitarity the same that viscosity breaks energy conservation in fluids. And I mean, that it might be worth taking that seriously, but so I mean, that's just all I wanted to say. Yes?
Yeah,
This is a very peripheral remark, but it might be pertinent a little bit. It's just about the thing about even the very idea of, I forgot what your term was, not wanting things to be sensitive to cutoffs.
Yes, technical nationalists, that's
right. Yeah. So just looking at the history of applied mathematics, one thing, so many of your actual numbers that you use, even in a classical setting, they actually get predictions, come from what look in your theory to be divergent expansions. And they have this mysterious behavior where you sum up 27 terms and everything gets really good, and then you keep sum, you should be able to get all these further terms, and then they get really awful. And it has tended to be that we still don't understand a lot of those things. It usually requires some incredible development in the mathematics. I take it there's modern work in optics where these formally divergent integrals that look like they're approximations become more primary objects in a rather fancy mathematics, okay, involving, you know, pseudo-differential operators and all that sort of stuff. So it isn't automatically clear that this is always a virtue that in the temporal moment you want to completely worry about, because you're using these calculations. I mean, that's the whole thing. Physicists get these amazing numbers by doing these screwball things that the mathematician can't justify. And it's usually some sort of symptom that there's some more complicated mathematical structure or integral, things that look like integrals are not really integrals. You know, it's just a little minor remark.
So you're talking about asymptotic expansions, or is that?
Well, just
terms that you're saying if they almost converge and then diverge.
Right. I mean, almost all your, even in the classic, almost lots of, because convergent integrals just take the equations for rainbow scattering. You know, it takes zillions of terms to get remotely near the right thing. There are convergent integrals, but there's a divergent integral where the first three terms give you. But if you keep going, then you get awful stuff. And they only work in sectors, so you get a Stokes.
But don't you agree that in order to use that in any meaningful way, at least there should be a regime where I have some stable answers, maybe between 27th term and 37th term, the answer doesn't change. And then, so that.
Well, no, I think that I don't really know examples. It could be pretty sharp.
Yeah.
Where you get a good answer in the very next term, you can really ruin it.
But then, don't you expect that a good answer? How do you know it's a good answer if it just?
Well, this is we don't understand these things very well. People are working, and when you do get a story, it often requires a whole bunch of mathematics that you're just not in a position to develop until you get more data on it.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to make a big deal out of this. For certain temporal intervals, as you're trying to do physics. Things like having to sort of tolerate rather mysterious, we got to cut it off here, I don't know exactly why right now, but still work around that, because this is your primary source of reliable numbers, or using these things. So you have kind of a nucleus of this, and then you hope that you get enough of a feel for things, and then you hope that the mathematicians are going to be able to help you out. But that usually takes about 100 years.
My point is that there needs to be at least some range that you have some sort of a stability after some range, like between 27th term and 27th term expansion and 37th term expansion. Maybe.
I don't know that should be true. With these asymptotic things, I'm not an expert at all on those, but some of those, it's like two terms are really good and give you incredibly good numbers. I mean, where we have convergent integrals. And then it could be that the very next term could be quite lousy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see. Thanks.
I think we should thank the speaker again. Yeah.
Thank you very much.